you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Walker versus Gutierrez.
May it please the court. Diana Faust will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. In interpreting Section 1301G of Article 4599, the Court of Appeals held that the trial court in this case abused its discretion in denying the grace period under Section 1301G because the evidence presented on accident or mistake, mistaken interpretation of the law, had not been controverted. In making this interpretation, Section 1301G, the Court of Appeals was incorrect in three respects. First of all, the evidence was controverted on the issue of belief. Second, the Court of Appeals inappropriately applied the abuse of discretion standard of review in this case. And when the standard of review third is applied properly, it shows that the trial court did not abuse its discretion.
Ms. Faust, the courts of appeals seem to, across the board, have used the Craddock-Bestlines standard for interpreting G with respect to what is something that was not intentional, the result of conscious indifference, but was the result of an accident or mistake. Do you agree that that is the standard that should be adopted under G?
Yes, Justice Hankins, we agree. The court is right. From the inception of the statute, this particular provision, when it was enacted, the courts began interpreting it and have looked to the analogous standards set forth in the Craddock cases, Craddock versus Sunshine-Bestline line of cases under default judgments and under 165A3 for dismissals for want of prosecution, and have applied those analogous standards and the analogous case law.
So we do not have a dispute in this case about the legal standard to be applied. We have a dispute about the state of the record in this case and whether or not that standard, the evidence that was offered, was controverted or not, which dictates the trial court's result.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that under this record, the Court of Appeals misapplied the standard of review specifically on controverted data.
Right, but I'm just trying to focus in on the issue. We're not debating between the parties here on what the legal standard is. We're debating about the state of the record and the application of that standard to this record.
That is correct, Your Honor.
When the question is abuse of discretion, does the court look at only evidence, the Court of Appeals, reviewing court, look at only the evidence supporting the judge's decision, or is the Court of Appeals supposed to look at both sides?
No, it does not, Your Honor. The Court of Appeals, the reviewing court, is on the issue of accident or mistake. The Court of Appeals is to review all of the evidence. And this court has set out rules of law concerning the abuse of discretion standard in this context. The court, number one, in this case, remember that counsel stated that he believed that the report that was filed complied with the statute. There's a mistaken belief concerning the interpretation.
And if it stopped at that point, would then the Craddock standard have been met?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, because in looking at the issue of belief, this court stated in Strachbein that if the evidence is uncontroverted, generally it's taken as true. And then later, the Koch versus U.S. Fidelity Guarantee Company case talked about how we interpret and controvert beliefs. Beliefs, inherently, there's no outward manifestation of a thought or belief. And to controvert that, the trial court and then the reviewing court must take and look at the state of mind and infer what that state of mind was through examining all the circumstances and all the conduct surrounding the failure to comply with the requirement at issue. And if the belief could be arrived at such that the belief did exist, but if it could be arrived at through conscious indifference in a careless manner or in a manner of an unconcerned regard that resulted in the inappropriate action or inaction, that could still controvert accident or mistake.
Well,
controvert.
Is that a question of controverting, or did that just fall over into the category of conscious indifference as opposed to accident or mistake? I mean, what you described sounded to me like conscious indifference as opposed to accident or mistake.
Well, Your Honor, this court has stated that evidence of accident or mistake will negate conscious indifference. And to controvert accident or mistake, then the court could look at all the circumstances in determining that it was controverted, could look at all the circumstances and determine that that belief arose through conscious indifference, what the courts have referred to as conscious indifference. And that is arriving at that belief in a careless manner or in such a way as to disregard and take inappropriate action or inaction in complying with the requirement that's at issue. So, although it's generally uncontroverted evidence is taken as true, when the situation is a mistake of law, and we're talking about a belief that constitutes that mistake of law, then we believe what happened here is that the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in not looking at all the
evidence. A mistake of law is sufficient under Craddock, is that correct?
That is correct. This Court stated in Bank One. This Court also stated in Bank One that not every mistake of law justifies or constitutes reasonable or adequate justification. And this Court indicated in the Smith versus Babcock and Wilcox case that when we're looking at conscious indifference, we're looking at whether the conduct and whether the reasons and the explanations given will constitute an adequate justification for failing to comply. So we're looking
at... What would a reasonable mistake of law look like?
Well, it's not easy when we examine the cases, Your Honor. But it appears that a reasonable mistake of law would be in examining all the circumstances, their arriving at that belief occurred through in a reasonable manner. For example, there are cases where the counsel received a citation in, or the party received a citation in, and believed that because there was a bankruptcy in this is the Carey Crutcher case, I believe, out of Corpus Christi, there was a bankruptcy stay in effect so that he was not then required to file an answer in that lawsuit. Looking at the circumstances surrounding how he arrived at that mistaken law, in that case, one can see no other circumstance that would have become available or that the court talked about that would result in conscious indifference or result in the party arriving at the belief through conscious indifference. There is no easy, bright-line answer in this case, in the mistake of law cases. And
but you agree that the court in all these mistake of law cases has tried to provide some standards so that you don't have identical facts in two different courts coming out different ways, where somebody doesn't have a lawsuit and somebody in the next courtroom over does. And that's the whole purpose of the Craddock effort.
That is the purpose, yes, Your Honor.
Whether it succeeded or not is a question.
And yes, Your Honor.
And you'd also agree that even more than defaults, I mean, the legislative scheme here seems to be to make sure that cases that go to trial are meritorious, but not to pour a case out just on a technical defect. You have 90 days or 180 days to get this affidavit in, and it says substantial compliance, doesn't it? It's got a wiggle word in there, and then it says if you miss that deadline, the court must give, and it's for good, what's the reason?
Accident
or mistake, then the court must grant this. So it looks like the legislature's trying to preserve the cases for trial with their meritorious.
That is correct, Your Honor. And if in looking at what the Court of Appeals did here, the Court of Appeals only looked at, in applying this abuse of discretion standard, it only looked at the direct examination and the cross-examination of the respondent's counsel at the time of the hearing. And it only then examined, in addition to that, what appeared to be evidence that would have considered direct, I think, direct evidence of knowledge that the report didn't comply with the standards. And
while,
that is,
while the court did not specifically say in this case, the Dallas Court of Appeals in the Whitworth case did say that under G, as opposed to under E, and D, we do look outside the four corners of the report to make a determination. You agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is why it is important for the reviewing court to look at all the circumstances and conduct surrounding that the record can show. And in this case, the record shows, if we apply that standard of review appropriately, the record shows that the trial court conducted four separate hearings on this issue. At the 90-day time period, the respondents filed a motion for extension of time to file the expert report, presumably to avoid having to post a cost bond at that point in time, as required under the statute, for each and every defendant named, and I believe we have five or six parties here today. In front of the court, there were additional parties in the trial court. The petitioners here filed a motion to compel the cost bond, and within that motion set forth and referred to the statute in section 1301R6, and that is what the expert report, that's the definition of the expert report and what it required. And in this case, the trial court started on down this road on these issues at that 90-day hearing. They had the hearing, and the court granted an extension of time to get the expert reports in, allowed the respondents to go forward with discovery before the reports had to be conducted. The court was in the best position, having conducted hearings over a period of time, several months, four different hearings, to judge the evidence, weigh the evidence, determine the credibility. The court looks as though, in the record, and we can look at the motion to reconsider, found at volume 4 of the record, the court has considered the entire circumstances and articulated the reasons. We were down here at the 90-day report, at the 90-day motion time. We had a hearing. The counsel stated under direct examination later that he was generally familiar with the requirements of the statute.
But he was wrong, apparently. He says he was wrong.
That is correct. He said.
So why isn't that a mistake of law under Craddock, under the Craddock cases?
It can be a mistake of law, Your Honor. But is
or
it
a reasonable mistake?
A reasonable
of law,
mistake.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Is it adequate justification for failing to comply with the statute, and that is to provide an adequate report? We don't believe it is under the circumstances because of everything that went on. The petitioners.
Well, we're not looking at adequate justification. We're looking at whether there was an accident or mistake, or a reasonable, and in this particular instance, a reasonable mistake of law under the Craddock line of cases.
Well, in this court, the trial court did that, and she emphasized in looking at everything that had transpired during the litigation that as early as the 90-day time period, the respondents were on notice as to what the statute required. They needed time to do discovery to get the expert reports put together.
Is there something ambiguous about the statute or the requirements of the statute or anything that would be a basis by which a lawyer might misunderstand what was to be required in this expert report?
Well, at this point in time, Your Honor, to answer your question, no. There's language in Section 1301R6. The report is to set forth a fair summary.
This all predated Palacios in the trial court, though, right?
That is correct. At this point in time, we didn't have the guidance of the case is saying that the plaintiff did not have to marshal all of its evidence and that we didn't have the benefit of those cases.
But a fair summary, that's all it said at this time. It was just a fair summary. It didn't tell you what needed to be in the report, like standard of care or what the item of negligence was or anything. That's not set out in the statute.
The statute requires that the report set out a fair summary of the applicable standard of care as to each health care provider, how that health care provider breached that standard, and how that breach approximately caused the damages, injuries, and harm that's complained of.
You have not argued whether subsection G is available if you file a defective report as opposed to no report at all, an issue that was also decided to put with the case. You agree that you can get a grace period extension for a defective report?
Well, Your Honor, we do agree that section 1301G would become available at that time. I think trial counsel may have taken inconsistent positions early on 4 years ago without the benefit of any interpretation on this issue.
Well, and the trial court didn't think that she was available to do that, correct? So when we say the trial court took all this into consideration, we don't really know that.
Well, I think we can know that, Your Honor, by looking at the hearing on the motion to reconsider. The motion to reconsider was only based on section 1301G, and that's found at the clerk's record, volume 2, page 552. And in that motion to reconsider, they asked the court to reconsider the dismissal with prejudice based on 1301G and a new case that had come out at the time. They tried to apply the case to this particular situation. The court denied reconsideration.
But I thought the trial judge repeatedly said that she just didn't think it applied in this case.
That's what I thought.
She did say that.
I mean, I know it was raised, but if she didn't think it applied or was available, then that's a lot different than her making a determination that the requirements of G had not been met and denying the motion for that reason.
Your Honor, we believe that she did at the hearing of the Volume 4 record, the Reporter's Record, Volume 4, page 15, where she articulates and sets out the reasons beginning at the 90 days and why she believes in this instance that reconsidering the 1301G issue was inappropriate, the circumstances and conduct in the entire case. And she made that determination based on what she saw and her involvement in the case.
You indicated that one of the points you wanted to talk with us about was your view that the evidence in this case offered by the plaintiff was controverted or conflicting as opposed to uncontroverted. Can you very specifically and succinctly tell us what the conflict is?
The conflict arises, Your Honor, with the respondents coming forward, number one, in their petition, referring the court to the requirements of Article 4599, Section 4.01. They're stating their knowledge with respect to what's required with the statute. 90 days, they come forward again. They know they need an expert report. At 90 days, they're told, when we're asking the court to compel the bond, they're referred to the provision in the statute, 1301R6, that sets out the requirements of that expert report. And there's a hearing conducted where the parties discuss the need for discovery so that the experts can properly put together the expert reports. So all this was determined early on. This was not a situation where the first time the issue arose was at the 180-day motion to dismiss.
But the lawyer, as I understand it, testified that he thought that everything he did comported with all of those requirements. So his view was entirely, in his mind, it was all consistent.
It wasn't.
So where is the conflict then?
Your Honor, we believe that the trial court felt that the conflict was that it was inconsistent with that belief that from the beginning of the case and recognized the requirements of Article 4590I through the 90-day hearing, that the court believed it was inconsistent with that belief. And the trial court had to make a factual determination as to whether there was accident on the
state. His belief that he had satisfied the statute was inconsistent with the facts of the case, that he was aware the statute required certain things to be in the...
That's exactly right.
But I understand. I thought that his view was, he's following up on what Justice Enoch just said. I thought that his view was, yes, I understood the statute required a report. I understood it had to be a good faith effort and a fair summary, and it had to include the elements of a cause of action. But I thought that this particular report in saying these things was sufficient to comply with the statute.
That is correct. That's what he stated, Your Honor. But I believe the trial court in the record shows that the trial court considered the other evidence of what occurred at the 90-day time period.
Is there anything else that is part of your argument that it was the evidence is conflicting or controverted?
Well, his admissions that he was aware of the basic requirements of the report, he prepared a format for the expert reports, and then he failed, when he got those reports back, he failed to double-check those or even to look at those to see if they did comply even with what he believed that they needed to include.
Do you think that the Dallas Court of Appeals properly applied the Craddock standards in the Whitworth case?
I do not, Your Honor, for the reason that the Dallas Court of Appeals in Whitworth relied on this case in determining that.
Well, I understand, but in terms of applying the Craddock test to the evidence that was presented in that case, just looking at the specific application of Craddock, do you believe that they correctly applied Craddock? And following up on the Chief's questions about, you know, what is the reasonable mistake of law and what are the standards?
I believe it did, Your Honor.
Okay.
There is another case, though, Your Honor, the Cope versus U.S. Fidelity and Guaranty, that specifically looks at the type of evidence required in looking at mistake of law arising out of a belief.
Okay, but if I understood you correctly, you just said that as far as the application of Craddock in that case, that one's right, this one's wrong.
Cope is correct. That's
No, but Whitworth. But Whitworth is correct in terms of application, and so it's a nice contrast between this case, between the record in that case and one in this case. I'm just trying to get the bearings on how all these cases fit.
Well, Your Honor, in Whitworth, I don't really recall all of the facts, other than I think in that case what's different is that it was the very first time the attorney had ever filed a report.
Okay. And so that made that application correct.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Charles McGarry will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. McGarry, before you begin, I just have one question. If the same circumstances had taken place and Palacios had been decided by then, would you still have an argument, a valid argument about the state of law?
If the Palacios decision had come down before the initial reports were prepared, I think our case would be much weaker. I think the fact that this all took place before Palacios was decided left the standards, the applicable standards, much in doubt. As counsel for petitioner has admitted, the arguments made by the sides have evolved. This case has been a constant process of education and learning.
But are you saying, I just want to be clear about this, are you saying that any time a lawyer says, I was just mistaken about the law, then he's got the additional time under G? Or are you saying that if this same lawyer had Palacios in front of him and it was in existence and still said mistake of law, then he would lose the case?
Well, I think you'd have to show that he actually had conscious awareness of Palacios and had read it and knew about it and was indifferent.
So the cross-examination is, what is your knowledge of the law generally? I mean, have you read the latest Supreme Court opinions come down on this issue?
Actually, I think that's true, because this court in Smith versus Wilson, Babcock and Wilson said that negligence is not conscious indifference.
What lawyer would ever say, you know, if his client's case is about to get dismissed, you know, if he doesn't say, I was just simply mistaken, I have an honest mistake, I didn't know that statute was out there, or the Supreme Court came down with a decision?
If you want an excellent example and a published opinion about how to controvert the exact type of mistake alleged in this case, you look at the 14th Court of Appeals case in Nguyen versus Kim, in which there was a complete failure to file a report, and the attorney came forward and filed an affidavit saying, gee, I just wasn't aware that the law required a report by this deadline, and and the defendants in that case introduced controverting evidence that they had actually written a letter specifically warning and advising the plaintiff of their failure to comply and that the deadline was upcoming. That controverting evidence negated the allegation of mistaken understanding of the law.
I haven't read the statute. I didn't know I had a 90-day requirement. I'm sorry.
That's absolutely true. It, no matter how negligent you are, this court has said negligence is not the same thing as conscious
indifference. But why isn't it conscious disregard just to choose not to read the law?
Well,
why doesn't that spill over from negligence to conscious disregard if you sit there and say, well, I don't think I'll read 4590I, and I don't think I'll research to see if it's been interpreted, and then,
under the facts of this particular case, you didn't have that intentional disregard of, gee, I know the law is out there, I'm not going to read it. In this particular case, you had a man with limited experience who had filed a similar report, another case, without any type of objection, and had been led to believe that he was complying with the statute and his standard practices.
So would you draw the line? Would you call that a mistake case? But would you call someone who chose not to read 4590I or research what cases had been decided interpreting 4590I, would you call that conscious disregard?
I think not, because I think you're going to end up on a slippery slope, which is exactly what you're doing now. If you try and distinguish between reasonable mistakes of law and unreasonable mistakes of law, I don't think there's any principled way to draw that line as to what's a reasonable mistake of law. If you got the law wrong, you got the law wrong.
Let me ask you on that point. Is this the standard of review that we're doing of the trial court's determination? Is this an abuse of discretion or a question of law?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I do agree, and in fact I think Palacios requires that this court presume that the legislature, in adopting the language out of Craddock, intended for Craddock to apply. However, there is going to be two limitations on that analogy. Number one, Craddock is a court-made rule, which this court is free to modify, limit, or repeal entirely. Whereas the legislature adopted and incorporated the body of law under Craddock as it existed in 1993 when it passed the statute. And if this court were to decide to overrule or modify Craddock in the common law context or in the context of Rule 165, that would have no effect under what the proper standard would be under 1301G. Secondly, I do think, even though all the courts of appeals agree that abuse of discretion standard applies, I simply think that that's not true. And the reason is because Craddock was dealing with the granting of a motion for new trial after a default judgment. And the rules specifically confer discretion on the trial court in the decision whether or not to grant a new trial. Whereas the language of 1301G is expressly mandatory. There's nothing in that statute which gives any discretion whatsoever to the trial court. So it's impossible for me to understand how you can apply an abuse of discretion standard to a mandatory statute which leaves the court no discretion. In fact, the only decision for the trial court to make under 1301G is a simple fact-finding. Was it intentional or with conscious indifference or not? And unless this court's prepared to say that the discretion involved in making a fact-finding is subject to abuse of discretion and apply that to every trial on the merits, then I don't think it's simply possible to apply abuse of discretion standard to this case. Now, as a practical matter, I don't think there's any difference. I don't think.
Whether there's any difference or even just saying it's kind of a question. De novo review by us, I guess.
I would say factual sufficiency on the factual finding of mistake or accident.
So if this mistake of law question really is a decision of whether or not the lawyer made a mistake, is not the judge free to disbelieve the lawyer's mistake?
So well, if you judge
it's all based on whether I just made a mistake of law, and the judge looks down there and says, well, as I read the law, it's hard for me to imagine how you could make me mistaken about how you apply that. And then the judge decides against it. Well, aren't we kind of stuck with the credibility of the witness being in the trial court's discretion? Your Honor,
under the existing law of Craddock that existed at the time that the legislature adopted this statute, this court had held that if the evidence of the facts alleged concerning mistake, the fact in this case being I did not have conscious awareness of what was required, I thought it complied. The law under Craddock says that if you don't controvert those specific facts, you lose. And the grace period has to be granted, or the new trial has to be granted. And so Craddock, even though it applied abuse of discretion standard, really narrowed that discretion down almost to nothing, saying that if you have this evidence of mistake and it's not, and the facts aren't controverted, then you have to grant it.
Short of a confession by the lawyer on the stand that no, he really didn't think that this complied, the mere statement, I thought it complied, gets you.
Yeah, and you know, if defendants want to avoid that scenario, again, in the Nguyen case, provides a blueprint for doing that, which is, I mean, the petitioners have argued in this case that the Court of Appeals effectively imposed some kind of notice duty on them, and we argued no, it didn't impose a duty to give notice of a deficiency to the other side, but that's an extremely important and relevant fact to deciding whether or not the plaintiff's attorney really was acting with conscious indifference or really was ignorant.
Well, if I'm of the old school and I think you all practice your law your way and I'll do mine my way and we'll go down and get an adjudication and don't want to write that letter, do I have no way around the filing of an affidavit that just says I was mistaken, period?
Yeah, I would say no, I think there is no way around it unless there is some other objective evidence that he really did have knowledge. In other words, impeaching his credibility. And I'd like to finish, if I could, just very briefly. And the other point that I want to make is that the equitable context of granting a grace period is significantly different from the equitable context of granting a new trial after default judgment, because if you have a default judgment and a new trial is granted, you're imposing an extreme cost and burden on the other side of having to go through discovery and a full trial and possibly losing the case on the merits. If you grant a grace period, that imposes absolutely no cost or burden to the defendant. The case just merely sits for 30 days.
Let's follow up on that. How many bites of the apple do you get here? Let's say I'm the plaintiff's lawyer, and I go get my expert affidavits, and I say, Judge, I think they meet the statute, and the judge says, no, they don't. Well, and then I say, well, I was just mistaken about the law. I'll go out and do it again. I come back, Judge, they met him this time. The judge says, no, they didn't. And I say, well, I'm mistaken about the law, Judge. I just read this case differently than you do. How many times do you get to come back and the lawyer says, you know, I just read this case differently than you do, Judge. Give me another chance.
Okay. That's a very good question. And two courts of appeals have addressed that question and come up with similar but slightly different answers. Just this past week, and I have the case cited here. Just this past week, the 14th Court of Appeals out of Houston, Thomas versus Healthmark Partners, on October 17th, decided that you get one grace period to a customer.
But that's not what the statute says.
Well, because the statute is singular, you only get one. The concurring opinion by Justice Morris in the Whitworth versus Blumenthal case said that the fact that you've gotten one, it posed a hypothetical that if the court's already told you once that your report's inadequate and given you one grace period, it would be awfully hard to come back and prove another mistake that you're still mistaken a second
under
time.
Under your theory, why is it so difficult? The lawyer says, well, okay, now I've read Palacios. I didn't know about it. I've read about it. I get there. And the trial court says, no, you didn't get there. Well, and I said, well, Judge, I'm sorry. I just didn't read it carefully enough.
No, because...
Now, why isn't that a mistake of law that gets you there?
Because under those circumstances, the claim of mistake of law is clearly controverted by objective evidence in the record where you have a hearing where the court has told you your report is inadequate because A, B, and C, and this is what you need to correct, and you got 30 days to do it, and so the record belies.
No, but then you meet A, B, and C, and you come back, and there's another deficiency, and say, well, so, you know, I just didn't know. I mean, how many bites do you get?
You know, and I think the petition is right. Every case is going to be fact specific, and Justice Morris said that it's not going to be impossible to get a second bite of the apple. It's just going to be very difficult. But if that hypothetical occurs where the court says it's deficient because of A, B, and C, you got 30 days to fix it, and you fix it, and then the second time around they come back and say, well, it's also deficient in D, and the plaintiff's lawyer hadn't been told that before, well, under that circumstance, I think you get a second bite of the apple. But it's going to narrow it down to the point where there are no more bites, and in the vast majority of cases, unless the court adopts the 14th court's view, which is automatically you only get one bite of the apple, it's going to be one bite of the apple.
The plaintiff gets a bite as long as there's an objection by the defendant, and the plaintiff can say, well, I thought I'd made it, but I hadn't. So every time there's an objection made, you get another bite of the apple. Simply by saying, well, I thought I'd made it, but I guess I was mistaken.
You know, there's going to be a hearing. The dismissal under E requires a hearing, and it's going to require a determination as to how, under L, how the report is deficient in order for a court to make a finding that it's deficient. And so the plaintiff's lawyer in that situation is going to be told. He can't possibly claim that he was not aware of the deficiency after the court's told.
But he gets 30 days after that hearing to cure the deficiency.
He gets 30 days.
And then if there's another objection on different grounds, as long as the defendant keeps objecting.
On
separate grounds.
Yeah, if
it's
different grounds.
The plaintiff always gets another bite,
Well, that just, you know, the cure to that is the defendant should put all the grounds in the first objection. Or objection in the first.
You say this would be a much weaker case if it had happened after Palacios. Let me finish. What did Palacios enlighten us on that would have helped this lawyer know how to file an expert report?
There was really no definition of what a fair summary was. There was really no definition of what a good faith effort was.
Yeah, but this doesn't even get close. This
leads
things back.
It's conclusory, but it addresses all the elements. Now, let me point out one thing I think is important factually. As far as I don't really think there is no conflict or controverting evidence regarding mistake in this case. And I think if you look at the entire record of this case, it's compelling as to his actual innocent mistake in this case, because what you had here was these original reports, which were very conclusory, but a series of motions for summary judgment that were filed for the express admitted purpose of getting those reports fleshed out. And the same doctors who filed these original reports that were found inadequate filed summary judgment affidavits in this case that were much more detailed, that would have complied, had they been submitted instead of being summary judgment affidavits as reports under 13.1G. So it's a difference in form rather than substance, which is the only reason we're here, is that the ones that complied were submitted as affidavits in response to summary judgments instead of reports. I mean, I think that's compelling evidence that this case had merit.
Did the trial court ever rule on, were those summary judgment motions ever presented to the trial court?
Never ruled on.
Never presented
for a hearing, though. The dismissal came first.
You said the affidavits were, all of that was, issue had been joined on all that at the point in time that they went forward, so the defendant chose to go forward under 13.101 instead of under Rule 166A, and at that point in time, both of those options were there.
Correct.
What about the one doctor where you didn't file an affidavit at all? How is that a mistake not to file anything at all after you've been granted a grace period?
Well, I don't recall an individual doctor not having an affidavit at all.
Mosier, I believe.
Starts with an N.
Mosier. That's what the briefs say.
Okay. I'm simply not familiar with that. I am familiar with the fact that a professional association wasn't mentioned in the reports based on a belief that since their liability was vicarious only, that you didn't have to have a separate report for that. Let me, if I can, crystallize what I think really this case is about. Four courts of appeals have addressed the precise issue in this case as to whether a mistaken belief that a report complied with the statute requires the granting of a grace period. Three courts, including the Corpus Christi court in this case, the Dallas court sitting en banc in Whitworth, and the Texarkana court in two separate cases, Roberts versus Medical City and Horsley Lemon versus Angeles, all agree with our position that the mistake that occurred in this case requires the granting of a grace period. The other case that's out there that holds to the contrary is the San Antonio Court of Appeals in De Leon versus Vela. And in that case, and I would point out that De Leon was reaffirmed just 2 weeks ago by the San Antonio Court over a very vigorous dissent in a case called Doadis versus Syed, just decided 2 weeks ago. But De Leon held that an accident mistake under 1301 requires a person's inadequate knowledge of the facts or an unexpected happening that precludes compliance with the statute, and cited only one case in support of that holding, Nguyen versus Kim, which is, I've already made reference to, out of the Houston 14.
Well, now, I'm trying to square up our decision in Palacios with what you're arguing here. That we said in Palacios that if you fail to address each element that the statute requires, that cannot, as a matter of law, be good faith. And how can we say you don't meet the good faith standard if you just totally omit addressing an element that the statute explicitly requires, it must be in the affidavit, yet say, well, that can be something that can meet a lower standard than good faith, which is necessary?
Because Palacios adopted an objective standard of good faith from the four corners of the instrument itself, whereas a grace period under 1301G, as the petitioner concedes, is a subjective test regarding conscious indifference or the intent of the acting party, and you have to go outside the four corners of the
body. Whether
you
go outside or not, we said if you don't address every element, that can't be, quote, good faith. And good faith to me is a more lenient standard even than negligence. And we say, no, you don't get there even under good faith, but that can be something that will excuse you on the negligence.
That may be our common understanding of good faith, but that's clearly not the standard of good faith that was adopted in Palacios, because if you adopt a objective standard within the four corners of the instrument itself, you are necessarily not considering somebody's subjective intent or conscious state of mind, which is what good faith in the ordinary meaning usually refers to. And so one point about Palacios I do want to make, and what I want to suggest here, is that there is a black letter rule that can be adopted for determining whether a mistake justifies a grace period or not, and the distinction is not whether it's a mistake of law or mistake of fact. The distinction is not whether it's reasonable or unreasonable, negligent or not negligent. The standard that this court should apply is whether, number one, are the facts of the mistake controverted or not. If they're controverted, the trial court can find either way, and you have to uphold the trial court. If it's not controverted, you look at the facts and you ask yourself, are these facts of the nature that supports an inference that the case lacks merit? Because that's the standard for due process under Transamerican that Palacios expressly said it was following. Now, I would point out that there is some friction between Palacios and Transamerican, because there is a line in Palacios that says that if the four corners of the instrument don't comply, that sufficient to infer that the case lacks merit? I would suggest that that's not logically correct if the failure to comply is the result of an innocent mistake and the case really has merit. You look at it from kind of a metaphysical standpoint, the case either has merit or it doesn't. And then the question is, why did the evidence of whether it has merit or not come before the court? Was it because of a mistake, or is it because the evidence doesn't exist? And that's the test you look at, because that's the purpose of the statute, to eliminate cases that lack merit.
Counsel, your time.
Thank you.
Does the petitioner say you have no evidence in the affidavit about it? Mitis, M-E-I-C-H-E-S.
Excuse me. Mitis, okay.
So you might want to go, if that's not in any of your briefing, you might want to explain to us.
May I submit a short letter brief on the subject?
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Just a couple of responses and rebuttal. It's clear in the record at the hearing, the hearings on 2 days concerning the motion to dismiss, the court allowed on the second day a record to be made on the issue of accidental mistake and this belief that the report complied. And at that hearing, the parties talk about and respondent's counsel concedes that there's no standard of care set forth in these reports as to any.
What about
the
affidavits in response to the motions for summary judgment?
The affidavits in response to the motions for summary judgment, I believe those affidavits are much more comprehensive than the expert reports that were submitted for purposes of the 4590.
Would they satisfy G? Would those affidavits have satisfied G if they were submitted under that section?
I haven't reviewed them specifically, Your Honor. They possibly could have, but I would like the opportunity to look
if
at
them. If they would have, why should the case be dismissed?
Well, Your Honor, the motions for summary judgment, if I could just walk through this timeline, the hearing on the 90th day required them.
Counsel, your time is short. I think the question, I have the same question. If they would have satisfied G, then it would be pretty technical for us to say that they're lying about the basis of the mistake. I mean, they sort of put what the court needed to analyze G in the record. It was before the court. The other side had it. If they were sufficient, then why should we decide dismissal was a proper result?
Well, Your Honor, there were two different types of motions to dismiss, or motions for summary judgment that were filed. The first one, I think, that was filed before the dismissal motion was our summary judgment on the lost chance issue. In other words, was there a greater than 50% chance that this infant would have survived? And so it wasn't until a second summary judgment was filed, I believe 2 weeks after the motion to dismiss was filed, I think that these reports were submitted. I may be wrong on that. My timeline, I only have the one summary judgment down here. There was a conference on the summary judgment about 2 weeks after the 180th day. That, I believe, was on the motion for summary judgment concerning the issue of whether the infant would have had a greater than 50% chance of survival. We believe we conclusively established it did not. And that was the basis for
that. Why shouldn't this case have then been decided on summary judgment rather than on a sanctions motion under 13.01? If the purpose of 13.01 is to weed out unmeritorious claims at an early point in time in the proceeding, in this case it advanced to the point where it was to be where summary judgments were filed and affidavits were filed, why shouldn't we be, as Justice Jefferson indicated, why should we be looking at a technical basis for disposing of this case rather than an actual disposition on the merits?
Well, Your Honor,
because either you get your summary judgment and so you win the case, or you don't get your summary judgment, which means they controverted to a point that the claims are meritorious and 13.01 shouldn't apply.
Well, Your Honor, there's no deadline for a defendant to file a motion challenging the expert report, which is what we did here.
Well, I understand the legislature has not included a deadline, But as we said in Palacios, the point was to make this available to defendants to dispose of a case very early in the process so that unmeritorious claims did not require the expense of being fully litigated to the point of summary judgment.
That is
doesn't that defeat the purpose to say, you know what, I'm going to let the case be fully litigated and wait till it's 2 years old, and instead of filing a summary judgment motion, I'm going to ask that it be dismissed on sanctions? That seems inconsistent with what we said the legislature intended in 1301.
And, Your Honor, that's not what we have here. What we have here is that the 90th day after filing suit, the trial court ordered us to produce our defendant, our clients, for deposition. So the facts were out at 90 days. The facts are out. We did have to go forward. We did have to defend ourselves because the trial court gave them an extension to get this report in. So we were already having to defend ourselves in what we believed was a non-meritorious lawsuit. This is not that.
At the hearing on the motion to dismiss, did the plaintiffs offer the affidavits that have been attached to the motion for summary judgment to the trial court and say, these are sufficient, Your Honor, even if our original affidavits don't get there? Look at our summary judgment affidavits. Did the trial court have those in front of her or him?
They did not offer those affidavits. The trial court specifically confined her review to the expert reports. They discussed them. I believe they indicated to the court that they had filed other affidavits in response to summary judgment. That was discussed, but they did not rely on them, and they did not introduce them.
Thank you, counsel. And that concludes the argument in the second call.
All right.